All right, Bing Bong, I am back with another edition of the Macro Insights podcast where I've got the man, the myth, the legend in the house here, Josh Pardue. So Josh, we obviously went through 2008 not too long ago. There's a little shakiness in the economy now. People are worried about interest rates. There's obviously the election coming up. There's a lot of underlying macro factors. But one of those factors is commercial real estate. We saw the mass exodus from California, New York, to places like here, beautiful Tampa, Florida. There's still some shakiness in the commercial real estate space. So, you know, is that big enough for another potential 2008, or is that something that worries you here going forward?
Yeah, Brandon, thanks for having me. I mean, look, there's a ton of risk associated with upside down commercial real estate across the country right now. A lot of different banks, not too dissimilar to 2008, kind of delay and pray, work with the borrowers. Sometimes private equity groups are coming in and buying the note and restructuring it with the owner to kind of cram them down. With that said, it did have a lot of potential to create systematic risk. You saw a few of the bank failures and some of the emergency actions taken by the federal government. With that said, 2008 was residential. There's a lot more residential real estate than commercial. And because of how the banks and borrowers can work together on commercial, we're now at a point where it looked like we're going to fall off a cliff. However, the Fed now made the adjustment. Maybe some argue it's a little late. The Fed could have adjusted a little earlier. They could have also adjusted the other way a couple of years a little earlier. But given that, they're trying to make a smooth landing in the short run. And I think that will work. And we're going to see that in 2025 is going to be better. 2026 are going to be better markets for commercial real estate. And the economy is not going to tank. With that said, the contrarian argument is we've been this giant asset bubble since 2008. And if you looked at the charts, they slowly grew coming out of the recession. Then they grew really nice all the way up through COVID, Trump. Interest rates low, COVID pulled back a little bit, and then we've been on this crazy growth thing since. Yeah. If you look at the technical analysis charts, and we're pretty high still on asset value.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you seemingly could throw a dart at a dartboard and just pick an asset, and you're going to do pretty well in it, you know, especially since the COVID time with all the massive amounts of money printing and everything else. But, you know, you did bring up the Fed and lowering interest rates, right? So we're recording this, October 26th. They just cut 50 basis points a month ago.
Right.
Probably going to cut again here before the end of the year. You know, but that hasn't really moved at least personal mortgage rates, but that does affect a lot of the commercial real estate. So we'll get into personal in a second. But with the commercial real estate, the floating variables, how the lending tactics go, you know, is that a potential factor where, you know, maybe somebody got into a commercial real estate property when interest rates were at zero and now they're here at 5.5%? Is that going to be another factor where, you know, even though people have left, that the values of these buildings have gone down dramatically? Or are those only extreme cases?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. The forecast of rates continuing to drop, the assumption is that the banks that have waited to completely take all these properties back and cause more turmoil within the system, they know that rates are now falling. So the borrower's issues often weren't even the borrower. What it was is that they modeled a deal, called $100 million with 5% interest rate. All right, so you're $5 million and $100 million of debt. Mm-hmm. However, the rate went to 8. So you went to $8 million of debt service. Well, that extra $3 million, I mean, that was your NOI. That was your cash flow. That was your return. So your debt service coverage ratio, or your technical terms, did you make your payment is one thing. That's a monetary default. And then there's a technical default, which almost everyone in the country, well, I should say a lot of projects, and that's really the driver of the concern. So if the forecast is rates are going to pull back, the assumptions banks will continue to work with borrowers.
Yeah. And like you know, we brought up 2008 at the beginning of this. The bigger issue, I think, during 2008, and correct me if I'm wrong, was just essentially they were lending to anybody and everybody, right? Teachers were getting $500,000 and everything else and not able to prove it. It seems like they've learned their lesson. But I want to see your opinion on the overall banking and lending industry with that. Have they still been throwing money around willy-nilly, or?
Well, it's true stories. I can tell you, I was earlier in my career investing in a lot of residential properties at the time, and I was doing 80-20 loans while studying finance in school with some entrepreneurial ventures, asking myself, wow, this is great. I'm able to get this much money. So I do think that we've learned from that mistake. But what happens with an economic recovery, people forget. You know, that's why Buffett says buy when people, you know, people are scared, and then sell when people are really good. It's because people forget, and that's where we're at right now. Just like to put it in perspective, we're talking about 2008, but there's been several major issues before that that we haven't lived through, and your audience presumably hasn't lived through. And so I think the real gorilla in the room is there another systematic reset needed? And the answer, if you study history, is yes. And we look at how long can the Fed play play scientist in the basement in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, it seems like it's a house of cards, right? I mean, like you brought it up earlier. Some would argue that the Fed raised interest rates too late. Some would argue they raised them too quickly. And then now some are arguing they're lowering them too late. And they're lowering them too quickly. So, you know, it is a system imperfect because it's run by humans. And they're looking at backdating data, which I think has always kind of been the issue, right? You're looking at CPI.
That's right.
We'll get the CPI print here for October in November 15th or so, around that time. You know, it's the same kind of thing, right?
If you look at the baskets they actually analyze within that and the weighting of it, it's totally political at this
and
point.
They've changed it so much. I think, you know, during the peak was maybe 9% reported by CPI. But if you look at the way they calculated CPI in like 1986, I want to say, which was the first time they changed that basket of goods, it was like at 15% or so. So, I mean, you know, even looking at the way that they used to calculate, it's all data, right? It's something that's being manipulated.
That's right.
But, you know, I want to go into the just personal housing kind of market and see. Just I'll leave it kind of broad. Like, how do you view the strength of that market right now?
I've always been a fan of primary and investment residential real estate. If you look at different assets and some things that are finite and infinite, land on the earth, there's a certain amount of it, right? Proximity to urban cores, there's a certain amount of it. Residential real estate, of course, is a primary need. And so I'm still and will always likely be a fan. Now, returns on it, or cash on cash, or cap rates that you could get out of buying are way lower than they were at previous parts in the cycle. That's maybe because there's more capital, more efficiency, institutional money is now buying homes. With that said, if you're able to still get single-digit returns, depreciation, pay a mortgage down, it's still one of the best strategies for most starting out investing, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, and I agree, right? I mean, if you're looking for something with cash flow, there's obviously a lot of tax benefits. You know, we had Trump previously in office. He's a big real estate guy, so presumably if he gets reelected here, he'll be very beneficial for real estate investors again. But you mentioned something that I think is pretty interesting there about the institutions buying up. I saw an article that said, you know, that BlackRock and other 1,000 plus door owners have been buying up like 70% of the homes here in the Tampa Bay area. And it's been like that for at least the next or the past year or so. So, I mean, I know it's more Tampa specific, but there are some other markets across the globe that are like, or across the country that are like this as well. Now, is that something that worries you going forward, or is that something that, you know, potentially is driving up the prices of single family homes, or do you think that that's all just kind of hubbub?
It's absolutely driving up the price of single family homes, and it's doing two main things. It's creating affordability challenges. If you look at what people used to earn relative to the purchase price of a house, It was a fraction of what it is now in relation. The purchase price is 4 or 5 times more relative to that 50-year ago relationship. And so that's a huge challenge. And then the other thing that happens from the institution side is what they're looking at is, okay, if we're getting bonds and we're in this range for low risk, and we agree that real estate or residential real estate is low risk. Now, they have to put a management company, an asset manager. It's a whole lot of layers of cost, but they're still getting single-digit returns that are stable, so they can pay more than the average guy like you or I that's looking at it saying, okay, I used to get a 10% cash on cash, or how much money I put in relative to what I get after I pay my expenses and my debt. While the institution's like, well, 5%, but that's okay because they have so much money to push out. So two arguments. Is it unfair or unhealthy for the average homeowner? You could certainly make that argument. The free market economist and big picture globalist guy can say, this is just evolution of business and the movement of capital markets and money and through through our evolution as a species. Yeah,
it is always interesting looking at that. And, you know, I don't know how much time you spend on Twitter, but if you ask the average Twitter investor, they think a lot of this is driven up by the Airbnb investors. Now, I want to hear your opinion on just that market as well, because I think, like, in 2020, everybody kind of saw that, right? Lower than 3% mortgage rates. They all went in, bought Airbnbs, didn't really care about the whole industry as a whole, and now we're seeing some of those people start to weed out. So I'm curious what you think of and your opinion on Airbnb investors as just kind of a whole and how it's developed in the past 4 to 5 years.
Do I think it's driving some of the residential market demand? Certainly, right? You're taking units from hotels and you're pulling that demand and you're putting it into single family houses. And that that drives demand. Am I against that though? No, I think it goes back to an abundance mentality versus a scarcity mentality. If you study the real winners right now, right? Like Uber doesn't own any vehicles, okay? Amazon for the longest time didn't own or manufacture products. They were just an intermediary, right? Airbnb doesn't own any property. Wow, this is some crazy stuff to happen in 20 years that's different than the history of mankind. With that said, you have to go back to the overall progress, free markets, and efficient flow of capital, and what's kind of best and highest. And so kudos to a lot of young entrepreneurs that are figuring that out. And it's almost like akin to the cannabis situation in this country, where the local and federal governments are trying to figure it out as they go, along with all this technological evolution.
Yeah, it's interesting, the technological revolution that we're seeing, right? I mean, you mentioned Uber. Uber hasn't made money at the entire time it's in existence. It's just all been, venture capital money being dumped into it. And in large part because they anticipate Uber's going to have this route for all these automated vehicles. Yep. So is there something that you see potentially, you know, maybe getting rid of hotels where Airbnbs are just, you know, either people are owning single rooms in these hotels? Like, do you see that as like a potential development? I know that there is some places like in Nashville that have like a combo of Airbnb, apartments, condos, kind of in a single building. Do you see that as like kind of a future developing in this industry?
In forward-thinking markets, they're sampling more with the concepts of letting folks be 12-month rentals or monthly rentals or nightly rentals and doing that. And I think it's going to take a natural progression to whatever's most logical and creates demand. Of course, the downside is that there's transient people in with long-term people and that conflict and renovations. The plus side is, you know, sometimes when you're at hotels or different places, it has a cool new vibe because there's new people. So I think the markets, the efficient markets, are just going to fix that problem.
Yeah, for sure. So, we've kind of been dancing around a little bit on the single family home, but I want to get into more of like the supply issue with everything. Because, you know, the narrative is that, you know, majority of mortgages now are below 3.5%. Most people are not going to want to sell out of that house to get into a new mortgage that's higher percentage wise, even though their houses has appreciated a bunch. Maybe they bought it in 2020. Maybe they bought it before and refinanced and everything like that. So, you know, how are you looking at, I guess, the supply demand kind of conflict that we're going on? Because I've, you know, just anecdotally, I know a lot of friends that have said they're going to wait until mortgage rates come down, and then it's like seems like everybody's going to be doing that.
As far as actually exiting or buying new.
Yeah.
Well, and it cuts both ways, right? Because you're going to sell high and then have to go buy again high.
Yeah.
And then your interest rates are that. I think instead of focusing on the individual transaction, I would look at it more as a macro life strategy.
Yeah.
If you're long on real estate and you got 20, 30, 40 years left in your journey, you start putting it in, and it's almost dollar cost averaging. Of course, you're better. The old saying, they'd say in the 50s, like you buy your toilet paper when it goes on sale. Mm-hmm. There's no difference in real estate. If there is a pullback, that's when you should buy. With that said, if your strategy is long-term hold, you have to believe in that technical analysis chart. Things are going to keep growing.
Yeah, no, I hear you with that. And I think, you know, obviously real estate is usually a safe investment, especially if you're buying in a place like Tampa. And I want to get into, you know, just kind of like the boom that we've seen here in the past 4 years in Tampa. Obviously, we've had Water Street and other places like blown up like that. You know, we've seen a lot of people move down here ever since, you know, COVID broke out, but not quite to the extent of like a Nashville or an Austin or a Miami, but still a very big jump. So how are you looking looking at a market like Tampa, maybe some of like the mid markets that saw, you know, a big jump during COVID, maybe are leveling out a little bit now?
Oh,
or
yeah,
so?
The Nashvilles and Austins have certainly cooled off.
Yeah.
They were too hot to touch for a while. Look, Tampa's growth has been fun to see. As someone that moved here a little over 20 years ago, at the time I found it an awkwardly good value proposition, quality of life. I'm a big fan of traveling and experiencing, seeing different cities to learn from that, going to the urban core, checking out the mixed use projects, trying the local food, getting into the unique, nuanced neighborhoods. So when I would come back to Tampa, it was always a little bit more vanilla and strategy. But the recent growth was, I think, some of the national market starting to figure it out, cost of living in Miami and New York and all that shooting up. And then COVID, of course, hit. And, you know, with political factors and freedom and health, and Florida was blessed. I won't get too into it for whatever reason, not get too crushed with COVID. Of course, the density in open air out and about versus the subway of urban markets in the Northeast. You know, there's some stats there. But it took off during COVID. And then I even joke about Tom Brady. Like 10% on property values. That man carried the city alone. And we're now, I think the real question is, are we at a point now where there's enough international, you mentioned Water Street, there's a few other projects that are going on, working on, that are instrumental. Is that cultural tipping point to where it's now a top national market? That cat's out of the bag, and I think it is. And we're just gonna continue to approach Miami pricing.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seems like rent is getting to that area close to Miami, if not there already. But, you know, it's funny you mentioned Tom Brady, because I do think sports and that kind of what's going on in the city does play a big factor.
Tampa had a good run.
Obviously, we had Tom Brady. We had the Lightning here. Yeah. The Rays aren't half bad, too. So, I mean, they had a World Series run. Unfortunately, didn't win it. But, you know.
People fly in, too, and they see it, and they feel the vibe. And, oh, you know what? I was thinking about moving to the Southeast, and I'll end up staying there. But don't underestimate the power of, we had two hurricanes.
Yeah, let's get into that.
I mean, as a real estate investor, you have to sit there and ask yourself, you know, how long do logical people experience these items? The same free market economists that came from the Northeast and California because of lower taxes and different economic benefits, lower cost of living. At some point, I have projects that insurance has gone up 3x in a few years on commercial projects. And it's hard to even fathom. You'd expect 10, 20, 30%? No. 300% increase. So you can imagine what that does to your bottom line. And so now we've had two more, you know, costly storms, maybe not as bad as it could have been, but at some point, the logical folks that moved here are going to say, you know what, taxes in New York are bad and the snow is bad, but storms flooding our houses every season isn't great as well. So
yeah, so let's get into insurance, right? Because you brought it up. It's, you know, it's gone 3x for some of your projects. I know, you know, that in just the national average as a whole has gone up 40%. So I mean, house insurance has just gotten astronomical, right? I mean, yeah. So they've tout this CPI number of 2.5%, but if you look at, you know, some of the cost of living statistics, it's just through the roof and way higher than what they're telling us. So, you know, do you think that there's going to be, I guess, almost a shift someplace that they're going to have to change either house insurance or how they're insuring some of these buildings in Florida because of, you know, what we've seen in the past couple years? Obviously, we had one hurricane last year, devastating to Fort Myers. Yeah. And then here we had two storms back to back in a week. I know we joke here about the Indian burial ground, however, you know, people, you know, really take that into account.
Yeah.
But, you know, hasn't been a great 16 months for us, to say the very least.
It's kind of a cost of doing business, or a cost of living is the other way to look at it. And the overall cost of living is still low. Of course, waterfront is night and day different. There's flood insurance. Should the markets innovate is where my mind goes. Are there other insurance products and niches and strategies that we're missing right now? hopefully, can we innovate our way out of it? Like we have Musk over here, okay, legitimately looking at people saying 20 years we're going to be set up in Mars. And at the rate he's going, you can't totally disagree with him, because you look at the innovation curve hitting like that. And so then you have to ask yourself, like, how do we innovate to better protect our planet and to keep, you know, keep the water down and the storms down, which I don't get into too much that topic, but I will say the last few storms are much larger than the ones when I was growing up, when you're just looking at it from the satellite.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. I mean, yeah, this past one was the first one I actually evacuated for in the 6 years that I've lived here. So
the media scare is good.
Yeah, and I didn't have power for 10 days, so I'm actually glad I did end up getting out. But
okay, good call.
It ended up working out well, but my mom was, you know, freaking out watching from news in Texas and everything like that, just seeing how bad it is. But like, to that point, right, I think that there's always going to be a give and a take no matter where you live and kind of move to, right? So like California, right? Yeah. Obviously, you got the massive amounts of taxes, but there's earthquakes out there depending on where you're at. New York, you got to deal with snowstorms, maybe blizzards at certain places like upstate. Florida, you got to deal with hurricanes, right?
So free markets.
Yep. So
they'll all balance themselves out, right?
Exactly. I think like it will eventually. But, you know, why do you think that we've seen the drastic increase in insurance prices? Do you think they're maybe equating it to this, like the national disasters, even though we get these hurricanes every single year and it just hasn't been like a big direct
hit? I've been meaning to actually spend some time studying the profit and losses of the insurance companies.
Yeah.
And to see how like these regulatory allowing them to increase and those things actually work in the short and long run. There are bonds, there's catastrophe bonds out there that'll pay a 10% return, which is great. However, if something hits, your bond gets wiped out. And so that I go back to that innovation thing. And at some point, my actual concern as a Florida-based investor, and maybe half of our projects are Florida and half are nationally right now, which is somewhat intentional to diversify geographically. It's not so much the current increase, but the concerns that if it keeps happening in 10, 20, 30 years, and at one point we all say, uh-oh, I need to slowly start trickling out of the state because this is happening. Like Miami is going to be underwater. We're not going to innovate through it or find ways to adjust the climate. I don't know if you noticed in Dubai, but they're now creating storms over there, if you've caught that, with like ions and lasers
exactly.
and stuff.
Yeah, it's crazy because like they're like, you know, the big real estate argument is always like, all right, you can't create more land, but that's exactly what they kind of did in Dubai,
yeah,
right?
At a big level.
Yeah. So, but obviously there's some positives and negatives to that. I know some friends over there that have had their cars flooded recently and just had some big old storms and everything.
A lot of Miami Beach is man-made, and that's gotten hit very hard.
Yeah.
In New York City, where they did add man-made. The few high rises, of course, you're going into the slate with your pillars up there. The bedrock is very strong. However, when you're along the edges of New York where they added it in, there's a few buildings that are having like 6-7 inches of lean.
Yeah.
Man-made.
I mean, you can't beat just like naturally made things, it seems like. So,
well said.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, at a certain point in time, we're just not going to be able to develop, like you said, with like creating more land or anything like that, just because of the dangers of the underlying aspects of it. But I want to get into, you know, COVID and the massive run-ups that we saw, right? Yeah. We talked about insurance with that, but there's also been the big, you know, equity that, you know, a lot of single family homeowners have accrued through these past 4 years or so. I know in the past 5 years, this is the government data, said that the Tampa Bay area alone has seen a 90% increase in the average home price.
Feels right.
Yeah. So
still a crazy number.
Yeah. Is it like, I mean, if you think about this now, if you have basically $1 million worth of real estate and this happened, I did this calculation just to think about it for myself, but say I have $1 million worth of real estate. I'm 30 years old. By the time I'm 65, if this keeps happening in Tampa, it'll be worth over $1 billion. So obviously it's not sustainable.
It's a nice compounding. Well, look, it can't continue to grow at this, right? It's not
exactly.
Not even close to sustainable. And so you have to look at that. The trend can't keep going up forever. It won't. Free market economics don't allow it. The other thing to recognize is we keep poking at the inflation thing, though. Mm-hmm. But if your properties go from $1 million to $2 million, however, your dollars were 50% less, you didn't exactly double your money, because what mm-hmm. you should be tracking is purchasing power parity, mm-hmm. more so than how many zeros are in my bank account when I look at it on my phone.
1,000%. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I feel like a lot of real estate investors, or just investors in general, are looking at these things, right? And they're seeing the numbers that the government's putting out comparatively to equity, you know, equities, stocks, how much they're making and all these, the percent returns and everything like that. How do you, as an investor, somebody that's developing all these kind of things in the real estate market, compare it to inflation and look at inflation when, you know, to see how much you're actually making, you know, based on the purchasing power?
Well, you can look at real versus nominal, and that's the textbook response. But of course, land is a good hedge of inflation because of how it tracks in that situation. However, with costs and interest rates also going up at disproportionate rates, even though rents in a lot of major markets have skyrocketed, the cost and interest rate have actually made projects in the last couple of years not economically viable, because they outpaced it. While 2000, coming out of COVID, it was that skyrocket, and then of course slowed down with 7-8% interest rates. You know, I think going forward, it's an unfair game in some ways, because those with the assets are going to be way out ahead. And my understanding, you study this topic in the history, whoever has had assets has ended up getting an unfair advantage. Yeah. With that said, I mean, I'll poke at my case study. I came from nothing.
Yeah.
I came from $0 in a small town in Daytona Beach with public schools and some public programs, and I showed up every day and I worked in this country. I worked hard, I did the right thing, I took a long-term perspective, and I started slowly building up assets through some ordinary income, some capital gains, and I did that, and I'm now early 40s, and America has treated me very well. But I've worked the system right. I recognized it was an unfair game. I said, well, I'm just going to have to do that to figure out. I don't know how I'm going to own my first property, but I'm going to figure it out. And this country will still do that for you if you're willing to do things the right way.
1,000%. And yeah, I mean, thanks for sharing that. I mean, I'm with you on that too. You know, I mean, I think this is why, part of the reason why I started doing all this stuff, because, you know, I started learning about a lot of the inflationary stuff and everything like that, just on my own time, listening to podcasts, other things like that, talking to people like yourself, because nobody tells you any of this stuff in school. And if you don't invest now, you know, I have many friends here that, you know, are my age, maybe a little bit younger, late 20s, early 30s, that own no assets, maybe some stocks, 401k, and they think that, you know, by the time they hit 65, you know, it compounds, they'll be a millionaire and everything will be fine. But I try to tell them, by the time we're 65, if this thing keeps going the way it's going, $1 million is not the $1 million we're at today, right? It's going to be worth significantly less. So, you know, with obviously 2020, we saw 60% of the money supply being put into the circulation there with massive amounts of money printing. Yeah. I'm kind of under the theory that no matter who gets elected, you know, because we're going to be lowering interest rates, that's going to happen again. Yeah. Now, that's obviously good for some of the prices, but that also could be kind of an unhealthy balance. How are you looking at that? And are you kind of on the same wavelength with me where you think that basically money printing's coming along, whether it's in the form of lowering interest rates or actually money printing and putting more in circulation, which will thus drive up asset prices and will kind of increase that wealth gap?
I like to analyze both sides of that discussion, Brandon. One observation is that, you know, a couple of years ago when inflation was rampant in the States and we had the conflict with Russia, Ukraine, and we're getting, you know, massively involved, and Russia worked with some of its partners to take, I think, 6 or 7 or 8 countries off the U.S. dollar quickly enough that I'm all of a sudden looking at it saying, like, actually, this could change our quality of life while we're alive on this planet as Americans. Because you ask yourself, like, what are the things? We're also born and blessed to be in this country. Mm-hmm. We don't take it for granted that we're a microcosm to the quality of life of the rest of the world. Like, let's not forget that every day as we wake up and complain about our problems. So when that happened, I started asking myself, like, wow, the U.S. currency isn't the global currency anymore. What's going to happen in my lifetime? And I started looking a lot into it. And it is crazy that we are still so far ahead as far as the global currency that we're not even close. And you look at military spending, you know, we're $800 billion while China is like 10%, $80 billion of that. And then, you know, China is concerning, but like they have their own problems I won't get into. And when you go through and you study that, but I was still nervous about the gold standard and inflation. And I'm digging and doing some research. And one of the funny comments that I heard was, someone sent me a video. It was an old wise mentor of mine. And it was a big fleet of the U.S. Army. And it was something like, this is now our gold standard. Meaning that the global strength of our economy, our flow of information, our flow of money, just how our innovation, really, how powerful we are there, protects us and allows us to print money. Now, look, printing money is wrong. The biggest thing that I think it does is it shows lower generations how to not be fiscally conservative. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not an advocate for it. I'm just pointing out that maybe it wasn't as concerning there as I'd thought. When you move to the other side of the argument, Ray Dalio wrote a book called Principles. Mm-hmm. He's one of my favorite American, we'll call him a capitalist entrepreneur that grew a hedge fund, top in the country, and then kind of he got to his journey, 60 years old, similar to myself, like, all right, making money's great, but like, what am I gonna do to actually get back and start teaching and educating young people? And he started creating this material. One of them's Why World Superpowers Fail. And he took Rome, Greeks, mm-hmm. the Dutch, when they created their ships and they were leading the world. And then, so when the Dutch created the ship a few hundred, 400, 500, 600 years ago, it was the first sailing ship. And so they all of a sudden had global commerce. That was the beginning of global commerce. And then the English and the rest of Europe, the Spaniards, the French, hey, that's pretty neat. We're going to build them fast and innovate. And that's what really how Europe did a lot of what it did. But if you study those markets that I mentioned and you now pair it against America, okay, and what post-World War II, America becomes a new superpower. We became that superpower because after we won World War II, we went and marked out all the trade routes, put our cruise ships there, and made it safe for global commerce. So if you want to do business, America is now brokering the world. And so you're either on our side or you're against us. And a lot of people chose to follow American safety, whatever, mm-hmm. globalism and some of the benefits that come from that. But the concern now is if you study those previous markets, Rome, Greece, they all eventually failed, right?
Yeah.
London, England's no longer the superpower. The one trait, there's a series of traits that Ray explains of why superpowers fail. And one of them is the printing of money.
Yep. They all get off of a hard money standard, right? So when we got off of the gold standard in 1982
or I'm impressed that you have the date memorized.
Yeah.
It's a good date to memorize.
Well, there's a great website. You should check it out. It's like WTF happened in 1971. Excuse me. I think
it's 70s.
Yeah. I think it's, 1971. I'm going to get ripped in the comments for not knowing this, but WTF happened in 1971, but it shows basically a correlation of a lot of things changing when we got off that gold standard. And it's crazy. I encourage you to go and look at it on your own time as well. Like obesity, all these different kind of crazy things. It's wild how much is connected to the money. But yeah, generally speaking, all of those empires failed within 100 years of going on like a fiat currency standard.
It's hubris. You start believing that you can kind of do whatever you want. And that starts at the top, but it also generates all the way down to the generations and the young, right? Leadership is top down typically. So think about this. Europeans come to America. Mm-hmm. This crazy time, Native Americans, this, that, they are scrappy. People are owning their own businesses. They're producing their own. Successful people then would tell their kids, be a doctor, be a lawyer, be this. Yeah. So we had some generations of that. And then what's happened is America's had a lot of generations of success and prosperity. Well, men aren't made when times are good.
Yeah.
Men are made when times are bad.
Yeah.
And a lot of our country, and we're all to some degree guilty of not recognizing that. And so right now, so the current generations maybe aren't working as hard as my generation, the new generation, that. And maybe I'm not working quite as hard as folks were previous as an age group. I individually show up every day.
Yeah.
But like you take it all the way back to 100 years ago when people are getting up at 4 a.m. and building their own farm. And so that along with the lack of gold standard is a couple of things that America just needs to pay attention to.
100%. And, you know, part of that is obviously, you know, the underlying currency, right? You have parents who have homes that appreciated a ton because of all the massive amounts of money printing, which gets into having hard assets, which obviously, you know, real estate guy, you get it, right? I mean, if everything was priced in homes or something like that, or the dollar was priced or backed by the amount of real estate that we had, or something similar to a gold standard that we have, I'm not quite sure how the intricacies of that would work. Maybe we'd be in a better spot than we are right now, but you're developing a lot of projects here in Tampa. With a lot of things that we're kind of like lining out here, a lot of economic uncertainty. So how are you looking at just like the development of some of these real estates and projects as, you know, we're kind of in a little bit of a turbulent time, maybe at an impasse, depending on who goes into the election. I know every 4 years we probably are going to have this same conversation 4 years down the road. But how are you looking at it?
The observation in my lifetime is that the political system has gotten more extreme in both directions. And to me, it's disappointing that the word being presidential used to mean something, and they would show up and have healthy political discourse, respect for each other, and this is our new commander-in-chief, support that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously the internet, you know, extremisms, it seems like we're becoming more bipolar, which is concerning as a nation. You know, obviously during like 9/11, there was some unity. During COVID, there was some unity, but as a whole, we're all very well off and spoiled. Even the lower income classes relative to the rest of the world still have it, of course, amazing. I'm not going to get into the two political candidates, but the joke that I've been making lately is, what if 100 days out from the election, everyone that was registered to vote received a text message, and that text message said, "Would you agree to a hard reset of both political candidates? Clear the deck," meaning that both, in this situation, Harris and Trump, would get wiped off. And then the parties would have 20 days to find a new number two. And my logic is that there's so many great, talented, brilliant Americans that when these political leaders get their power behind them and the corporations, and they have the money and the momentum, their voters, I think right now that if you ask most of the country, should we wipe the two and try different? I think that would be an interesting study. Because right now we're forced to choose between ideologies and extreme situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's all fair to say. It's an interesting thought experiment. I mean, I always think we don't need to go too far down the political rabbit hole, but obviously everybody's got their eyes on it. It does affect things, whether or not they're going to sway the Fed. You know, the Fed was supposed to be bipartisan at a certain point in time, but now we've had back-to-back presidents yelling at Jerome Powell, telling him to lower interest rates, you know.
Yeah.
So whether it was Trump or Biden, he was there, both of them. They both wanted him to keep interest rates lower. So, you know, it's interesting.
Asset bubble. That goes back to the start of our discussion.
Exactly.
Drives the asset bubble. It's good for politics.
Yeah, 100%. So, you know, you said bubble, right? So bubble implies a pop. Do you think that there is going to be a pop, or do you think that because of, you know, all the things that we've been underlying where, you know, we basically got the drug of the money printing here where it's seemingly endless, right? The printer doesn't run out. You just got to put more numbers on the screen at this point in time. So with that, you know, do you think that it's just going to keep driving assets up and, you know, that's going to set the wealth gap farther apart?
I think that you have to frame that question with a time range.
Okay.
Is it in our lifetime or is it in general? In general, the answer is an astounding, absolutely. It has to pop. Mm-hmm. If you don't believe that, you haven't studied history and looked at general technical analysis. The question is, can the government, corporations, and some bright folks collude to continue to drive the asset bubble until you and I are no longer on the planet and we don't have a data reference? But it has to eventually pop. And does that mean that, the U.S. economy, how many more decades or hundreds of years will the U.S. economy be the global superpower?
Yeah, that's all fair to say. But let's get into the fun stuff. You've been doing some development here in Tampa, and you guys got a few different projects. So what are some things that are exciting you about these projects that you're working on? You've got some great stuff in Gasworks. I lined out to you a little bit pre-show that I bought in Ybor, historic area, because of the stuff you guys got going on in Gasworks. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we only got to touch on it for a second before we got started, but congrats on the investment in Ybor. My personal strategy has been half single tenant build-to-suit, half more opportunistic, and that opportunistic in the downturn was going after buying distressed assets, 10, 11, 12, raising money, buying things, believing Florida's really low, it's going to come back. The single tenant build-to-suit stuff, or medical, or retail, that kind of stuff, is a totally different asset class. It trades like a bond, while land and those properties move, of course, a lot more variable versus bond. Within that, the evolution of that, I've loved urban cores for my entire life. Since I was a kid growing up surfing at a beach, I lived in New York for a while. I'm like, wow, this is the learning curve for that. So when I would come back to Tampa and I'd look at its urban core in Jacksonville and some of Miami and South Florida, I would be amazed by the opportunity to better develop Florida's urban cores. And, downtown Jacks, we've got several projects right now. I've got some partnerships that I'm working with that are 10 plus year relationships to help drive some of the urban Tampa stuff. And the thing that, I'm a big spokesperson of right now is that Ybor, in my opinion, has been Tampa's number one asset since Tampa's Tampa. Mm-hmm. And markets go through cycles. And of course, the last 20 years has been a cycle for Ybor. Still a great place, but the next chapter is about finding balance. And that balance to I believe our group's ideology is that you're gonna have employment, you're gonna have daytime activities, you're not gonna get rid of nighttime and partying. Like, that's still gonna be a piece of it. The entertainment wedge of the overall economy is gonna go from that to a little sliver. Mm-hmm. Which it should be, a reasonable sliver. Sevens is still a destination, but there's a lot more to Ybor than Seventh. Going even north of I-4 and then down to Adamo, that's all treasure. Right, you got the bungalows, you've got mixed use, you got history, you got architecture. History is really what it's all about. And so bringing, right now there's currently over 5,000 units planned to go in right south of Ybor. And what that density is going to do is bring employment, it's going to bring more consumers, and that's naturally going to clear and find, I'm going to call it balance, and bringing Ybor back to the village it originally was.
Yeah, and I think that all that stuff is very exciting. So we'll get into some broader Florida questions. So, you mentioned Jacksonville, you mentioned Tampa. Obviously, we've got Miami. So which of the three are the best, and why is it Tampa?
let's define best, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What's the best for arts, music, energy, economic viability, wealth? But like South Florida is amazing. What is best for maybe we'll call it, go back to balance, quality of life, place to raise a family, upside, less density, still beautiful waters, beautiful beaches, Central Florida, Tampa. I make jokes about Mickey Mouse and that. I actually had Mickey Mouse extort us, charge $500,000 to build a storage facility in Disneyland. Yeah. That we built, we were fortunate to. And we had some surgery centers going on in Orlando, up in Jacksonville. They called that the first coast of Florida. Because right when the trains came down, when Flagler built that train, North Florida was developed first because they hadn't gotten all the way down to South Florida and the Keys, and Mr. Flagler, of course, visionary, popping up hotels all along his train ride. So catching the tourism dollar on the train and at his hotels, that's a different discussion. He's a legendary. But so when you look at the whole state,
they're north, like to wrap that point, though, North Florida is more south. The more north you go in the state, the more southern you get. Mm-hmm. And that's a unique Indy. It's a unique opportunity. The Urban Core has that. So the way that I've always observed it is South Florida goes up, Tampa goes up, Jacks goes up, and the markets are all following themselves. At some point right now, there's so much wealth moving to Miami. It's like the Dubai of the United States, right? Mm-hmm. And so people are getting priced out. And those people are trying other markets. And so those other markets are now rising. And then more New York, more South American money into Miami, pushing all that. And at some point, the New York says, hey, you know what? I'm gonna check out Tampa and that, because Miami is as expensive as New York City.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely seeing that here, where we see a lot of people from the Northeast, Jersey, New York, all those people are coming down here to Tampa here, especially recently. So I think the secret's out, unfortunately or fortunately, depends how you look at it. So, I mean, yeah. I think there's been a lot of development here. But, you know, what excites you, not only with your projects that you're working on, but of the development that you've seen here in Tampa? We mentioned Water Street. I think since I've moved here 6 years ago, we've had Sparkman Wharf turn up. We've had Armature Works, a ton of development.
Yeah. And good development and much, you know, much needed. Tampa was stagnant for a longer time. I mean, for over a decade, office rents were the same lower 20s full service in downtown. Just was just a sign of the slower growth. And that was the old leadership mentality, wanting to keep it a little bit more homely. That, of course, the new mentality is a little bit more open market, trying things. All the projects that are going on are great, and there's a ton more slated. I remember when Sky Point was the first high-rise downtown Tampa. I was living in that, and then the second project by Greg Mender and at Town Group out of Atlanta, and there was no one downtown yet.
Yeah,
I was just down there to be down there and create the few retail and a little bit of walkability. So to see go from that to now, I can't name all the downtown projects.
I can't either.
As a developer, an urbanist who loves this, I can't even keep track of them. And so that's really excited. It's also an observation that we're bringing a ton of luxury units, which to you at the start of the discussion is reminiscent of what got us in trouble in the previous cycle. But look, everyone's studying the migration, the wealth, and build them up. If anything, there'll be a little pullback. But as a whole, what this better product is going to do is a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because more people are going to be like, there's cool places to live and eat in Tampa.
Well, I also think it's something that's been interesting that I've noticed is a lot of companies have come down here as well. Is that something that you've noticed where you've seen like a lot of, companies? I mean, you know, just from the big macro, we've seen Amazon, Tesla, Twitter, all that move out of California into other places. I know like Kathy Wood, we had, she brought her ARK Hedge Fund down from New York down to St. Pete. Yeah. So there's been a lot of like big companies coming down here to the Tampa Bay area, not only that, but also to the south. So how big of a influx do you think is that, just people, jobs, money, et cetera?
And let's not forget, that's the number one KPI to track.
1,000%.
Right? Your employment drivers and your corporate headquarters and that creates base employment jobs. Those base level jobs or destination technical jobs are what allows the servers, the hair salons, all those second layer, third layer supplying. So when money comes in the money supply and it continues to roll and move, you need those base employers. And so to see that come to Tampa, come to the state of Florida, you really can't put a number on how important that is. And in my opinion, the only thing that's gonna slow that right now is insurance and Mother Nature. Or maybe, I mean, look, the political situation is so volatile, you can't forecast that. But as a whole, Florida should have a good run in the rest of our life, is my forecast.
Yeah, 100%. And then we touched on it briefly, but sports, right? We obviously have had some, controversy with the Rays, whether or not they're going to leave, stay. We just had the unfortunate, I actually think it might be better for the long-term health of the Rays, but the top fell off the Tropicana thing. We've had that, but we've also had a lot of success with the Lightning, the Bucks, all that kind of stuff. How much do you look, or do you look at that at all, of, potentially drivers of places to invest?
If you go back to the fundamentals, Okay. What do you need? Infrastructure. You got a good airport. Important. You need good interstates. What is Tampa lacking or trying to improve upon? The trolley system. Mm-hmm. The Bright Line coming in should have happened 10, 20 years ago. It got blocked due to political reasons. A longtime business partner and friend of mine was working on that in Ybor, working on getting the raise, of course, to downtown Tampa as an option. You know, I view the roof going off Tropicana as silly, for lack of better words. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, it's that facility's been dated. That's natural selection. Mm-hmm. Clearing it out. It's happening anyways with free market economics, but now, you know, Mother Nature took care of the Tropicana for us.
Yeah, the first game I ever went to was a Yankees-Rays game. There was more Yankees fans there. And the Rays were good that year, too. And the lights went out in the bottom of the ninth inning for 30 minutes. So I was just sitting there. I was like, all right, this is enough. So I think the upgrade has been much needed. But I'm excited about all the projects and everything that you guys got going on. Why don't you tell the listeners where they could find out more about the projects and yourself?
Yeah, no, I appreciate everyone. So what, a year or two ago, we were starting to do case studies for our projects and put them on YouTube under Joshua Pardue. And then what the team explained to me along the way is that sometimes it's not about the project case studies, it's about the mindset, the life lessons, the talking point to get us there. So we've started creating some online content to give back, mindset, finance, real estate. You just search Joshua Pardue. Joshua, P-A-R-D-U-E, and you'll find all the stuff there, and look forward to seeing you guys on the journey.
Yeah, 100%. I'll put all that in the show notes, and Josh, thanks so much, man.
Yeah, thanks a lot, friend. Appreciate you having me.
So I had a...